I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is the Nokomoto Podcast coming to you from Moto One Podcast Network Studios Recording Suite B. We're not in the Tiki Room today. We are at, well, Suite B, which is on the other side of the Moto One President's office. I don't know why he chose Studio B to be built on the other side of his office to give him even more headaches, but he did because he's an idiot. Now, I demanded that we build a tunnel from the Tiki Studio to this studio, and in hindsight, that was a little extravagant. We already had a hallway. We didn't need the tunnel, but it is fun to walk through the tunnel and then bang on the ceiling of the tunnel, annoy the president when he's having meetings. That's nice, because he thought, after covering the glass windows that were outside his office, because I used to walk by and just kind of like press my dick against the glass or whatever, but he covered that up. So now, anyway, long story short, we're in Studio B, not the Tiki Room. And that's significant because we just did some work to it today. We put up a bunch of sound panels. I don't know why we didn't have interns do it, but we did it. We're not sound panels. What, I don't know what you call this shit. It's foam. What
is it? It's just room foam.
It's just room, whatever. Yeah. So it should sound better. It's going to sound different than the Tiki Room, which you'll notice last week sounded different from the Tiki Room in a bad way. Hopefully, we're getting this room sorted out. I apologize for the horrific sound of last week's episode. It was, for so many reasons that I can't even go into, complicated reasons. We had to do a different setup with the recording equipment. Things weren't right. Hopefully it's better this week. It's going to take a few more weeks to dial in. I was impressed with how good the Tiki Room sounds, because it just turns out it's accidentally the world's greatest recording environment.
Well, yeah, if you throw enough shit on the walls, then it just kind of, it's natural sound dampening.
Exactly. Yeah. We're trying to, Swigs is this new awesome microphone, and he sounds great in it, but combining that microphone with this microphone in the same room is a challenge. There's like echo, his mic picks me up, it's all weird. Whenever he takes his foot off the cough box, you'll hear the sound change. I can hear it change when you do it.
Yeah, it's a bit more room noise on it. We may have to do the ceiling. But
yeah, that mic is too good, I think, is our problem. Anyway, so if it sounds weird, that's why. Now, what are we going to talk about in this episode? Well, we're going to try to make it a little bit of a shorter episode with me and Swigs, and then at the end, I may have an interview with the captain that gets tacked on to the end. We're not exactly sure. Also, this week, I don't know if it's going to be the day before this is released, the same day or the day after. I'm just doing a big double dump with the scooter episode. I've decided the scooter episode that we recorded with Dan is so difficult to edit without just at some point just abruptly stopping it. And not to mention the fact that when you put 7 hours of audio into any kind of recording equipment that you're not paying huge amounts of money for and don't have a computer with way too much RAM or whatever, for various reasons, it's slow, it crashes. It's 7 hours of audio is a lot of audio. That's a lot of shit to have loaded up at once. So if you're using something like Audacity, well, it struggles with it. So I'm basically giving up on trying to edit that episode. I'm just going to put it out with this. So if you're pissed, don't be pissed. You've got a regular episode that's not all scooter content that's going to annoy you. And if you're into the scooter content, then merry fucking early Christmas. You've got like 5 hours of Nokomoto this week. I think everyone can live with this. And it's less work for me, it turns out, after I've decided to not fall for the sunk cost fallacy of all the work I've already tried to put into making that episode listenable. I'm just cut and bait. We're just going to dump it out there. All right. So, Swigs, we're going to do Best Worst Bike in the World this week, and we're going to do some secret questions. and probably not anything else. We'll see what happens. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, so here we go, everybody. This is the best worst bike in the world this week. This is where Swigs and I will each have picked a motorcycle. One of us is going to have best bike in the world this week. One of us is going to have worst bike in the world this week. We don't know each other have chosen. It's always a surprise. Now, if you have an issue with what we've chosen as best or worst bike in the world, you have two options. You can send an email to contact@nokomotopodcast.com, or you can kill yourself. I'd prefer that you just send us an email, right? The second option's a little drastic, but I can't make that decision for you. Only you can make that decision for you. You might feel that strongly about it that it's really just best to, you know, take matters into your own hands, so to speak. All right, Swigs, you have worst bike in the world this week.
I do.
And are you ready to reveal it?
I am.
All right. And the worst bike in the world this week is?
The 1986 Yamaha Venture Royale.
Well, I believe we've done this bike before.
Well, we did the previous one. We did the 86 Venture. But this is one that we need to revisit a little bit, because
These are horrible.
Well, they are and they aren't. I did sort of pick one of these, the previous iteration of this, because it's technically two generations.
Well,
and the first
picked
one was
one
really
of
cool.
These as kind of a best bike, because you're like, well, it's ugly, but they go for no money, and it's got the VMAX engine in it.
Yes, so I'm targeting this one specifically because there were a lot of interesting things going on with these bikes, and in fairness, the first year that started in '84 got really, really schwacked because it came out the same year as the Goldwing Aspen Gate did.
Which there's just no competing with, and never right. has been.
Now, with a couple years of iteration and an opportunity to really put things together, you would expect this to actually do really well. And I think this sort of stands out as a little bit of a case study in that the raw figures aren't all that matters. Because in theory, this bike should be better than an Aspen Cade. It has air suspension like the Aspen Cade does. It has a 1300cc V4 motor, 4 valves per cylinder, and 4 carburetors, which should do significantly better. It does have an onboard compressor. Comes with a tape deck and a CB radio as standard. It has pretty much everything that the Aspen K does. It came with that upper fairing and rigid luggage that's fixed on. It's not an option. It's not. It's part of the base model. Like, it should absolutely smash it, but it doesn't. Even though it's got all
the
components.
Well, it doesn't components. Have the handling. It doesn't have the low center of gravity that the Goldwing had. It doesn't have the benefit of being the first. It doesn't have... I mean, this is 86, so the Goldwing has already been a model for 10-plus years at this point. What was the first year for the Venture?
For this model with the V4, it was 84, but that was with the 1200.
It's late to the party as well.
Yeah. They bumped the size up. Fun fact, the modern Venture only has like 4 more horsepower than this does.
Well, I'm sure this has adequate power. even by today's standards, I'm sure it does well. Wasn't this that's more like high 80s, low 90s on the power? Something like that, if I recall.
So this is like 87.
Yeah, that's plenty for a bike like this.
So I believe the way compared to the Aspencade, this had like 5 less horsepower, but like 5 more foot pounds of torque.
Right.
So they're kind of they're both kind of swapping over there. I would imagine you probably wanted a little bit more horsepower rather than the torque, just because, you know, like with your Goldwing, it's kind of nice just to hit that 90 horsepower for the weight.
I would have, well, supposedly mine is like, the spec sheet, you know, says 77, which is down a little bit. I think it was like kind of more like 80, 81 for earlier Goldwings. Mine did swap a little, was like retuned. In 78, they retuned the motor and they did swap a little horsepower for torque. A little bit. Or maybe they changed the gearing. They did something like that.
These bikes both have like 30 more.
I would swap another 10 horsepower for another 5 foot pounds of torque on the GL1000.
Okay, yeah.
But maybe. You saw like weighted down and everything. I hit 100 miles an hour, no problem on that bike. I mean, well, not no problem, but it did it. I didn't have to be going downhill to do it. A top speed of 90, I would be completely fine with on that bike. And a little bit more power going uphill would be nice, you know. But this is a few years later. This is better torque. This is better horsepower than that. The power numbers are not going to be an issue on this. Even today, you could take one of these, load it down, put your girlfriend on the back, and hit the highway, and you're going to do fine. You're going to be able to pass semis. You're going to be able to do everything. It's fine. It's fine. The problem with this motorcycle is twofold. I know they made them in other colors, supposedly, but they only exist in this awful brown in the wild. Every single one I've ever seen is this awful two-tone brown.
They're all like this weird kind of like station wagon trim.
Yeah, it's horrific. And let's also not forget that it looks like a Goldwing that a Vogon sat on and broke its back.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that what it looks like? It looks like you took a Goldwing and just smashed it down in the middle.
Yeah.
And broke the frame.
And, you know, most touring bikes do kind of have that high tank, but it looks so weird without any lowers. Without any lower fairings. Like, it just looks weird. It's the same problem that the Maduro has.
Yeah. But also, The super low seats with the higher handlebars, the extreme tank slope, it's just, it looks like it's broken in the middle. It does, and it's a problem.
It's kind of like, you know, when you've got like a 13-year-old dog, and every time it sits down, you don't know if that's going to be the last time it ever stands again.
Right.
It's just always drooping in the back. Like, yeah, that's kind of what it looks like. It does look broken.
You know, Yamaha aren't idiots. I'm sure it's sort of a rideable bike, at least by the definition of the times. But
yeah,
even as a hipster move, you can't even ride this bike ironically.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like, even then, like, even if it's acceptable for the time, when you compare it to like how Cam's 80s Goldwing feels, like it feels almost like modern luxury. The way, like how light that bike feels.
Yeah.
I strongly doubt that this feels anything like that.
Well, yeah, because there's no cult of vintage Venture Royale people. There are people that swear that every different incarnation of the Goldwing is the best version of the Goldwing there ever was and ever will be. There are people that just worship at this shrine of the name Goldwing, and then there are people that love every single model, or there are people that love sort of the different motors that they put in them and everything in between, there's all kinds of admiration. And everyone agrees that for a touring motorcycle, starting in 1975 through today, if you want the best of the best, it's whatever year the Goldwing was for that year. There's just no question. Everybody knows this. There are people that will tell you that it maybe it's like the Harley Davidson of that year, it's the Electro Glide of that year or something, but deep down, secretly, they know it's actually the Goldwing of that year. That yeah. They just have to rep their Harley thing so hard.
Now, ultimately, this bike did find its proper place as the VMAX. Although it wasn't this motor, it was the previous motor that they retooled and did the all the carb magic with and gave it more than 10.5, compression ratio higher than 10.5 to 1. But yeah, I think this is just kind of a nice case study in how it's really not just the spec sheet. There is something for the brand and how the whole thing holistically goes together. And even though technically this all matches up, it really doesn't compare at all. And the reason I picked this one is because I saw one on Craigslist the other day up in Cheyenne running in good condition for $650.
I wouldn't do it for $650, and I'll tell you why. It's from 1986, and it's complicated like a Goldwing, and you're never going to find anyone to work on it. And that V4 is a real specific motor, and it's all packed in there. And like a Goldwing, you got to take the thing apart in a million different panels and this and that and whatever. And it's complicated to work on. But at least the Goldwing, like, you can find, they're rare, but you can find Goldwing guys.
Right.
People that just kind of specialize it, because the bike has such a history, you know, and there's all these websites of just gold, like there's Randack Cycle Shack and Sabre Cycle, these places that just do Goldwing specific parts. And even though there's no dealership in the world that'll touch the bike or help you out, there's some sort of community and fan base around it that you can get something done with an old Goldwing. You're fucked with a Venture. There's no support anywhere. People will just actively laugh at you for trying to get it worked on or trying to fix it. It's an uphill battle. So I wouldn't do it for $600. I wouldn't.
Yeah. It's like, for them, it's more like, it's like, why don't we just put this in the crusher and put it out of its misery? Yeah. But ultimately, this kind of, you know, a lot of the features of this did actually, you know, find its home in the VMAX, which I think we're all grateful for. But
yes.
But yeah, I'll just finish it off there and say, yeah, this is a nice little case study, and you can't just tick all the boxes and hit all the same specs and then think that you have a competitive product.
The last thing I want to say about it is, a lot of Goldwings have aged into their look very well. You know, like the Vetter fairing kind of look goes in and out. The Honda line fairings kind of go in and out or whatever. I'm sure in 1986, a lot of people thought, and perhaps correctly, that this was better styling for 1986. But man, this is not aged well. This just gets weirder and more uncomfortable looking. You know what this is, right? If the Goldwing is, you know, your dad in odd sunglasses, imagine your dad at like a soccer or a football game on the sidelines. A Goldwing is your dad on the sidelines wearing your mom's sunglasses and cut off jean shorts. This is your dad wearing sunglasses on the back of his head, wearing Umbro shorts. Like, it's somehow even worse, right? Like, it's just it's just really embarrassing.
So actually, just as we're going through some of these photos, I just want to put a PSA out there to every motorcycle manufacturer. No motorcycle will ever look good in cream. It's a terrible motorcycle color, and you should just stay away
again,
from it.
Again, they claim to have made this motorcycle in colors other than brown, but they all must have caught fire as they left the factory. Every single one of them that exists in the real world today is brown. I see pictures of blue ones here. I'm calling Photoshop. I've never seen one not brown. I've never seen a black one like there. Yeah, I've never seen the blue. I've only seen the weird solid like. No, I take that back. I've seen the weird like champagne color, and I've seen the weird two-tone brown, but I don't think I've seen that white cream one ever.
I mean, they really all are just various. It is a wide array of shades of brown, but they are all essentially brown.
It's awful. It's awful. There's so much to love. It's so close to good, right? Because that V4 engine is going to offer a very distinct experience from a Harley Tourer or a Goldwing. You know, it's got like the integrated turn signals and the great big wide fairing. And it looks like that weird kind of fairing lower does do something to deflect a little bit of air off of your legs. And that little chin guard, you know, scooping up air. The luggage looks usable. I mean, there's all kinds of add-ons like armrests and backrests and things. Like, it's so close. But that little bit that it's off is really off. Because, again, there's no support. You can't buy one of these and confidently ride across the country with it. You can't do that. There's no support. There's no parts. There's no anything. You can't. You're fucked for like a vintage club riders group based around these. I mean, I'm sure one exists, but it's gonna be filled with fucking weirdos. There's just nothing to hang your hat on. The only reason to ride one of these is a relative of yours has one that's currently running, and then they die. And then you can just ride it until it stops working, and then you just need to put it out of its misery.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, are we ready to move on to best bike in the world this week?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. And the best bike in the world this week is? I can't remember the year, but it's definitely 80-something. The Yamaha SR250, known in some circles as Spamula, but there's a specific trim that I'm really interested in, and if you can find the one with the trunk. So the SR250, the little single cylinder version of like the SR500 or the SR400 from a few days, that's it right there. You found it, Swigs. So this is just the 250 single, two valve, you know, version of like the SR500, basically. In 1984, you could get one of these for, I can't remember how much, but an astonishingly small amount of money. And it was just a basic little motorcycle, no real flash. Not huge amounts of power or anything special, just a motorcycle. But, you know, like the SR500 and other things, these things have gained a reputation for being a really solid engine. I mean, I think we're talking like 17 horsepower here, right? Like top speed's going to be like low 70s, high 60s, something like that. But this is a great motorcycle that you could kind of afford as like an 18-year-old, something like that. I think that's kind of the idea. But I just love this move that we've really only seen also on the Honda Silverwing. When you bought it from the dealer, there was an option for this trunk that went on the back. And so it kind of like, it's like a backrest slash trunk, and it's pretty sizable, and it just clips onto the back, like over the back seat. When you take it off, there's a passenger seat there, and it's just a completely incorporated trunk on the back. It kind of looks like a pizza box on the back of the bike, but it's, you know, color matched to your tank and everything. And you know, there's a lot of other motorcycles that did exactly what this does. Little 250 singles, you know, Honda had 250 singles and 200 twins, and Suzuki did, and everyone did. Had a little road going four stroke little singles that every, you know, teenagers could buy for little money or whatever. And that's all fine. That's all well and good. You know, I think there was a Kate that, you know, this is kind of like the KZ400 would have been like about the biggest bike in this category at the time. But this move to put on this incorporated luggage on the back on such a basic motorcycle, it really reveals exactly who this bike was for, right? This is for someone that probably didn't have a car, or if they had a car, it wasn't a very good one, right? This was someone that was using two wheels as primary transportation. So what can we give them that makes this fit into their life way better than the competition, right?
Right.
And it's this luggage. And it looks a little goofy at first when you see it. But if you let the image roll around in your head for a while and you realize, oh, I can just unclip it, basically, and then I've got a passenger seat. I just put it on for when I need it to move shit around. Why doesn't this idea still exist today?
Yeah, I mean, with the amount of work it must take to design, like, a new model, as in, you know, to make a new frame and motor and to start putting stuff together, it's such a marginal cost to have, like, a factory top box. Or something like this where it just replaces the rear seat, like the pillion seat. It seems like such a trivial thing to do that, like, it can't, like, the marginal cost can't be that high. Especially when there's a lot of bikes that, you know, there's a lot of different models that'll have the same seat or a similar seat, or that'll have the same seat, like, across sizes, you know, like for a 250 or a 300 and a 500 or like a 400 and a 650. Like, it seems like, yeah, this should be more common.
So the only way that this idea sort of still exists is with some high-end sport bikes, like Ducati loves to do this. They'll sell you a bike, and there's a cowling sort of piece that you can put over the passenger seat that just kind of makes it a single-seater, kind of hardtail, like hardback look to it, right?
Yeah, well, even Honda did that with the VFR.
Yeah, there's loads of sport bikes that have done it, but the idea is, what if that was just a little taller, that piece that you put over the passenger seat, right? Instead of just simply being a cap that goes over the passenger seat, what if it was just a little taller and you could put shit in there?
What if
this,
like,
is so unbelievably usable?
Well, it's sort of like, if every passenger seat cover basically made your bike look like a Hayabusa, and then you just had all that space in there.
Yeah. Yeah, now this one's like very sort of square-ish and sticks up pretty high and whatever. I mean,
which I actually kind of appreciate, because
yeah, I want it to be as large as possible.
Well, it's just so blatantly, it's not trying to, I mean, it's trying to be a little bit nice with a decent finish on it, but like, it's so blatantly utilitarian rather than stylish, that it kind of has its own character in a way, which I appreciate.
Well, and this is the perfect kind of motorcycle to put it on as well. The internet has no shortage of articles you'll find of people talking about how this was their first motorcycle, or kind of one of those motorcycles that got away from them, sort of a diamond in the rough, sort of unrecognized. Like, oh yeah, everyone talks about the SR500, but that little 250 was really great around town and short highway stints, and, you know, put your girlfriend on the back and go out for a date or whatever, or ride back roads, or do your paper routes, or get you to your first job, or got you through college, or whatever. These stories are everywhere about this motorcycle. It's almost got a sort of like Honda CB350 kind of reverence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people seem to remember this bike very, very fondly. And, you know, Junkie from our friend Junkie from Creative Riding owns one that's been chopped apart and put back together in a bunch of different ways. But he swears up and down it's just one of the greatest motorcycles he's ever ridden. I believe him. It's a great motor. There's really nothing that can go wrong with this motor. If you've got oil in it, it doesn't really seem there's an easy way to kill it. And it's a real nice little lightweight, just sort of cool bike that if you want to chop it up in different ways and do different things to it, that's completely possible.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's also something to that as well, which is, you know, it's very common in the sport bike crowd to, you know, go over wet weight and dry weight, and where have they shaved off ounces and grams as much as they can to really get, you know, that high performance, you know, get that power to weight ratio down or up. And, you know, you can have one of the easiest ways to have a really great handling bike is just to have less bike.
Yeah.
And when you just got a 250 single and everything's nice and narrow and you don't have a lot of weight to stop, because you can, you know, and you've got this, then, you know, once the frame's a bit lighter, once you got a little bit less gas, once you've, you know, cut the way the transmission down, then the brakes get smaller and the suspension gets a little bit slimmer. And yeah, just having less bike is a great way to just have a great handling bike.
The more I look at this bike, I really just see a Yamaha XT250 with road forks and tires on it, and a road seat and a road tank. I mean, it's that kind of simple.
Yeah.
And probably almost exactly that kind of gearing and speeds and performance too. I don't think it's wildly different.
I mean, it may be that I think the only thing that's vaguely modern on the newer one is that I think the current model year
is fuel injected. Yeah, otherwise it's really not that much more sophisticated this. Yeah.
It's still just an air-cooled single cylinder 2-valve motor.
It may have gone to 4-valve, but it could easily still be
2-valve. I believe it's 2-valve still.
Which is great. That's what I want. Yeah. Just simple. Super simple. Doesn't need to do high RPM. Just let it. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I love this little thing. I like what the bike is. I like who it was for. I like this little segment of the market. I think there's a lot of ways that I think, you know, today, kind of your 300 singles are kind of doing what this did back then with a little bit more power. Why can't we just have this sort of clip-on luggage stuff? Everything today needs to be so aggressive and so whatever that it's hard to remember, oh yeah, this could fulfill a really important role in your life. And I don't know. I want more clip-on luggage options. And I mean clip-on, not bolt-on, clip-on. I want it to attach to the subframe under the seat, and it just clips, and it's there solid, and it doesn't obstruct your lights or your turn signals, and it just lets you take... It's like, okay, I'm at the dealership. I'm buying the bike. It's $9,000. For an extra $250, I can have this nice clip-on luggage option that will allow me to ride this bike twice as much.
Yeah. I mean, maybe something a bit nicer, like the, something... Well, I mean, this has, like, a very basic option, definitely. But I do think it's really nice having the key to, like, luggage. And if you could have it lock onto the bike, that'd be nice. Kind of like the...
Okay, fair enough.
Like the GV bags would be nice.
I bet there's a way you could put something on the subframe where it's both the lock for the door of it and it clips it. So, like, the subframe has something that's keyed with the ignition on it.
Or I guess, yeah, you could also just have it locked. You could also just have it locked, and then if it's lockable and you just have the release mechanism inside, that's another way to do it.
Or, I mean, just have like a big long cable or something so it unlocks from, like, you know, you turn the key into the accessory position and there's a linkage that goes all the way to the back or something. I don't know. There's ways to do it.
That's what the GV bags do, and it's really nice.
Or do it from the helmet lock, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the helmet lock is the way to go, actually. Have it do it from the helmet lock. Okay, cool. All right. So, yeah, let's move on to secret questions. Do you want to do the first? You know, you always go first on the best worst. Let's start a tradition that I'll start with the secret questions.
Okay, we can do that.
Here's a secret question. Did you know that Piaggio has put in a patent for small displacement, affordable, single cylinder swing arm motors with variable valve timing?
I did not know that. That is...
So that, for 50, okay. I don't know exactly which motor they're going to put it in. So let's just say, you know, for the 150s, right? But presumably this is for everything from 50cc up to, you know, their 280-something cc singles, right? But mm-hmm. Piaggio puts a swing arm motor in everything. And I think that the example that they used, it basically some people have taken apart, like, you know, every time someone applies for a patent, people just rip the diagrams apart. And it looks to be the motor that they're putting in the GTS 300 and the MP3. But it's very similar to... It's not like the VTEC like Honda does. Supposedly, this system is very similar to Yamaha's variable valve timing, except it's better. So it switches between two different cam profiles.
So it is a new variable valve timing technology then.
Yes.
Okay, so that's why. Okay, so I was wondering how that was patentable.
Like VTEC, it does split between two different cam profiles, but there's something, I can't remember what it is, but there's something about it. The timing for the less aggressive profile is kind of static, but then it allows the other profile to advance and retard the timing on the aggressive one, which makes a lot of sense. If you've got a CVT transmission, you know, people just, the twist and go might as well be on off, right? Anyone that rides twist and go scooters, you just kind of get on it and pull the thing to wide open throttle. right? That's kind of how everyone rides. So right. You're spending very little time on that first one anyway. But oh yeah, you've already got it up here. So it looks like this is going for 4 valve, and I believe all like Piaggio's current like 150 motors are 3 valve. So I think that's how they sort of determine like, oh, this is going to be for like the GTS 300 or whatever. But the idea is with variable valve timing, let's get even more efficiency out of these, because whilst everyone's like, oh, electric's the future, we're starting to see some companies going, well, okay, yeah, electric's a big part of our future, but it's not completely viable yet. We need to produce some. And, you know, there are few things out there more fuel efficient than a Vespa motor, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest problem in the scooter market with electric is just that, especially for the higher displacement scooters, is just that upfront cost to go electric is a huge punch in the dick.
Right.
And something that a lot of scooter owners are really not willing to pay. It's typically a very cost-sensitive market, which is why the Chinese models do so well.
Now, why is this important? This is important because this is basically what's going to keep things like the Vespa GTS 300, you know, Euro and California emissions compliant into the future. Because variable valve timing like this, I mean, you can, every time I say variable valve timing, you can just think of the term you already know, VTEC, right? This isn't VTEC, but it is VTEC. It's doing the same thing that VTEC does, just in a different way, because Honda's got their patents for how they do it. Yamaha's got their patent, right? Variable valve timing used to be kind of pretty special to Honda. Now everyone's got like some sort of version of it. But doing it in an engine this small and making it affordable, that's a big magic trick, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that you could have a 50cc or 150cc or 300cc motor with variable valve timing, you know, like why do you need variable valve timing? Well, the same reason that they don't make manual shift scooters anymore, like the reason they're all CVT, they have to get unbelievably like high amounts of efficiency out of these for the whole concept to work. You need this thing to take 1.2 to 2 gallons of fuel only and have a good amount of range on that. So you need fuel efficiency. Also, cars aren't getting slower, and with electric vehicles, things need to be able to take off the line quicker. So you need increasing performance out of this small displacement. Well, so what are the things... can have two different cam profiles, one gives you better efficiency at low RPM, where, guess what, the valves open for less amount of time and they don't open as much. Or I mean, it depends on what you're going for. You could get the valves to open for a shorter amount, open up a smaller amount, but for a longer duration, or for a greater amount for a shorter duration. There's all sorts of different things. But the point is, if you got two different cam profiles that you can use, well, then you could be optimized at two different points in your rev range instead of just one.
Yeah.
So for your spread of power, you're going to be able to make more power and have more efficiency across the wider band.
Yeah, and it's this is also another reason why they need that extra performance, is because they need to do it as efficiently as possible. Because I watched the Fort 9 video on the new ZR400 or ZX400RR, and they were talking about why it was gutted for the North American market, and one of the problems is nitrogen dioxide as a greenhouse gas. The problem is the way that that's generated, supposedly, is the fact that just if your engine gets hot enough, it'll start making nitrogen dioxide. And if you're going to get more power and not create it, you know, motorcycle engines aren't actually, you know, as you go for these smaller displacements, you have to generate more heat in the same volume. So any way that you can get more power and develop it more efficiently without having to create more heat, that's where you're going to get your gains. It's also why things like the W650 became the W800 and then went fuel injected, then went liquid cooled, then, or actually, did they make it liquid cooled?
No, it's still air cooled. Yeah. I think it's got a small oil cooler.
Yeah, but they, you know, they keep doing things to get the actual engine temperature down. We have materials. We can make insanely high performance motors. And I don't even think it really costs that much, but it's the emissions. I mean, if we had our way and everyone just went by Colorado regulations, everything would still be two stroke for one thing. But it's in order to keep up with emissions and really just hold the same performance that older models had, like, everything is having to get more elaborate.
Right. But I didn't realize this in reading the Cyclewold article. They say here that apparently the MT-125 and the R-125 or the R-12, whatever they call it, whatever. Yamaha's already putting variable valve timing in those 125s. So this is not ridiculous an idea at all that, you know, maybe the next batch, you know, the next update to like the Honda Forza or whatever, you know, their 160cc scooter is and their 300 and all that stuff is going to go variable valve timing, because how else are they going to keep selling it? You know, at what point is it cheaper to give it variable valve timing than add another catalytic converter?
Yeah, at some point, I don't know when we're going to get there, but I don't know how much further emissions can actually go.
My only issue with this is I've never done a valve adjustment on something with variable valve timing, and I don't know how difficult that's going to make the process and how familiar with different systems like this I would have to be. I don't know. Just as the engine normally sits, you would just set the gap, you know, with your shims or whatever, just as you normally would with the regular set of cams that's turning on it. But I don't know. I mean, because you measure the gap from the cams to the bucket normally, but if there's two sets of cam lobes, I don't know. It just seems like it could get complicated for doing your own valves.
Yeah, I have no idea.
But besides that, I mean, but you know, like, bikes these days just go so many miles in between needing this. Maybe it's worth it just to bite the bullet and have a shop do it.
Potentially.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I just thought it was really fucking cool. The idea that maybe in like 2026, a Vespa Primavera 150 might have variable valve timing, and without even bumping the displacement, go from 12.5 to like 14 or 16 horsepower potentially peak or whatever. You know, I don't know how much horsepower it's going to add, but it's going to add some, you know. And Vespa already kind of claims to be sort of, you know, their 150s, they're already only claiming like 12.5 horsepower, and they only claim like 80 something miles per gallon, where, you know, Honda will be like, well, we're at like 14.5 horsepower and we make, you know, whatever, you know, their numbers claim to be better, and maybe they are, but, you know.
I'm going to be a little bit more pessimistic and say that what's probably going to happen is it's probably going to be the same horsepower, but either they're going to drop the, they're either going to just, you know, inject less fuel and give you less power at the top end, or they're going to just lower the RPMs altogether. And that's what's actually going to happen. I don't think they're going to get any more powerful.
It's true. Vespas really haven't gotten any more powerful since, like, 1980.
Yeah, kind
of. You know, they've all just kind of done, you know, various ranges of speeds. They've just gone from two-stroke to four-stroke and managed to make... I mean, they haven't made significant things significant gains in power. It's just in efficiency. That's true. It's kind of like a Mazda with the Miata, right? They've stopped a long time ago. They stopped trying to make it faster, or more powerful, or better. They're just kind of refining it in different ways. Because they're like, you know, or Honda with the Goldwing and its range. They're like, yeah, it gets 200 miles range. And it has since, like, 1986. And it'll never get more than that because it doesn't need more than that. If it becomes more efficient, we'll put less fuel in and make it lighter.
Yeah.
That's you're probably right, actually. We're probably not going to see more power from Vespa. We'll see.
But we might see more fuel efficiency. And the bike may get lighter. That is true. But, yeah, I don't suspect that you'll get a more powerful scooter out of this.
Hmm. Okay. All right, you got a secret question?
I do. And this is a bit more general, but do we need to get motorcyclists to kind of rally and start advocating more for e-bikes?
Hmm.
And I bring this up because, I mean, there's been a few different things, and I think we need to start, because we are seeing... Yeah, the number of people getting their motorcycle license is dropping. But we're also now in this very... we've kind of gone through a few different shifts. And a big one came with the pandemic. That kind of changes just how we go about things and how we use vehicles. And I feel like there's going to be a lot of overlap with... cycling and e-bikes that's really going to work in motorcyclists' favor. So, I mean, a few things like, there's a lot more people working from home post-pandemic than there was pre-pandemic. So there's a lot of people who don't really need, there's a lot of families that were two-car families that could easily go down to one-car families. But also just in general... You know, nobody's strapping mattresses to the roofs of their cars anymore. Like, that is a
bygone... Everything can be delivered now.
Everything can be delivered.
TVs, mattresses,
and a lot of stuff is just ordered online. So, you have your neighbor who is one of, the city planners.
Right.
Was talking about how nowadays, before it used to be like, well, we just want to get throughput up. We want to get the road. We want to get people where they're going faster, and we want to not have lots of traffic. But now they're saying like, we'll actually want to lower speed limits, and we want there mm-hmm. to be, we want everything to be more business friendly.
Yeah, we want more parking and more walking space.
Right. But you know what enables a lot of parking space? Motorcycles parking. Bicycle parking.
Yeah.
And motorcycle and bicycle friendly stuff. Now, we're still in an American small town, and stuff's pretty spread out. And, having e-bikes is pretty great for that. But also, e-bike laws are kind of bullshit right now.
They are. It's all over the fucking place, and it's the Wild West.
Well, yeah, I mean, the great thing about it is that you can break the law with impunity because the cops don't know the laws.
Not at all.
And no one's ever going to check. But, you know, if you are just a law-abiding citizen, you're not going to go out and buy an e-bike that's illegal to ride on the streets. So, I feel like this is... When you look at how towns and cities are changing and how neighborhoods are changing, because there's so many things that you're not going to get in the car and go by. You're just going to have it delivered. And with a lot of transportation going smaller, I feel like if you support things that get more e-bikes on the road, you know, because we're also in a world now where, you know, the age of cheap credit is over, and there's going to be a lot less teenagers driving new cars. That's not going to be a thing for a long time. You know, pre-2008, that was a thing that conceivably happened for a lot of people. There are a lot of 17-year-olds driving, like, 1- and 2-year-old Honda Civics around. People did just, like, people said, like, I want my 17-year-old daughter to be safe. I'm going to get, like, the new Civic that's got the side airbags and all that stuff.
Or at least one that had been leased for a couple years and now was, like, 40% cheaper than new.
Yeah. But, you know, if your college kid doesn't need a car and everything that they actually need can be ordered online, and now... you're going to see a lot of those cars get replaced with bicycles and with e-bikes. And if you can make those rules a bit more lax, if you can have more kind of two-wheeled parking, if you can continue to blur the line between e-bikes and electric scooters and electric motorcycles, there becomes this nice little through line to get more motorcycle adoption. And I feel like we should be looking at that. Because I think with more working from home, more order online, more stuff being delivered, I think, you know, and just vehicles getting more expensive with cheap credit not being a thing anymore, I feel like that's kind of where things are going to transition from.
So I agree that we should all be behind e-bikes. If you recall, around the time we started this podcast was about really the time that e-bikes were kind of getting off the ground, and every manufacturer at every get-together we were at, whether it was like the Progressive Show or the AM Expo or whatever it was, or if we were at MotoGP, wherever we were, everyone was showing off e-bike models, and it was like, oh, Yamaha's e-bike, oh, Kawasaki's got an e-bike, right? And... The general consensus amongst the public was, what kind of idiot wants an e-bike? Don't you want a real motorcycle? And no one was really sure how these were going to necessarily fit into people's lives. It was like, well, okay, it's a bicycle, but you don't have to pedal as hard. That's still not super great. But, you know, there are people now... I won't name names that are concerned. They're like, oh my gosh, these e-bikes, they're so fast. It's like, we're talking about 30 miles an hour. Like, calm the fuck down. Yeah,
these are speeds that people hit on non-e-bikes.
Right.
Like, this is normal. This has been normal for like...
Put a big enough flywheel in the right gearing. You can do 70 on a regular bicycle. I mean, it's going to be brutal getting up to speed. But, you know, the idea is that everyone's idea of speed and power is getting recalibrated. And e-bikes are where that starts. So we've all now seen people... on the road on one wheels, which is ridiculous. One wheels don't go fast enough to be on the road. They don't qualify as low powered vehicles. Even they're literally classified as toys. These bird scooters or Lime scooters or whatever, these stand-up electric scooters that you can just, you know, rent for a couple miles are technically illegal in a lot of cities. They're not legal in Denver. They're motorized and they can't be on the sidewalks. And they also, they're not legal on the street technically because they don't have permanent fixed seats. You know, there's a lot of issues. Those things should all just go away and be replaced by regular bicycles with luggage racks and baskets anyway, because it's just more stable and less dangerous. And also they can hold more battery and go further and they have bigger wheels. And there's all sorts of advantages. And we're all seeing people like pick up $700 contraptions from Costco and go around town on them too, and a bunch of stuff in between. And some people are like, well, get out of my way, you're not a car, you don't belong here. And some people are like, I can't believe how fast these things are going, right? Everyone's idea of speed and power is getting recalibrated. And we're going to land somewhere sensible, but I feel that I am way more accepted on the road with my 50cc scooter than I would have been a couple years ago, because people look at it and they're like, well, at least it's probably got an engine in it and it's large and, you know, I think I can predict where this thing is going to go. And it kind of looks like a vehicle that goes on the road, right? I mean, because it is, yeah. But I'll tell you what, people fucking love that thing wherever I go, no matter what, if I wave at somebody on the gyro, I get a wave back. And then on top of that, people in cars wave at me every time I take it somewhere. Now it's someone's like, man, that thing's fucking cool. I think something like the gyro is going to find some sort of package of power and whatever, that something like that will become popular in the US. All the time, people are getting into this idea of sort of kookier and kookier transportation. And what they don't know is that the things that they're looking for already exist. It's kind of like when you have that boss and you have to pretend everything was their idea. Right?
Yeah.
Americans really need to come to this idea on their own, that some sort of two or three wheeled, you know, scooter motor powered or electric thing with storage is really something that they're looking for. But you're right. All of this starts with e-bikes. And back in 2017, 2018, they were all correct. It's going to be a bridge from nothing going up, right?
I feel like there needs to be a really big push to really like loosen the restrictions and let manufacturers play with stuff. So like it needs to be like to the point where, you know, twist throttle is legal everywhere. And you don't have to do it like pedal assist only in certain places. And it needs to be that like the 750 watt limit for class 3 is bullshit.
Like, I think it just needs to be a straight up top speed limit. That's it. Forget all the trying to compare ICE engine power to wattage, to battery power, to amps, to whatever, to all this. Just make it. No, if it has a top speed under this, it's a low power vehicle. If it can go faster than this, then guess what? You need to plate it and insure it and have a motorcycle license. It's really fucking simple. People have been trying to make it complicated. I don't care what the motor size is. I don't care what the watts are. Just what's its top speed? There you go. If you get clocked doing over than that, all right, then you're going to have to show some paperwork. That's it. That's it.
Yeah. But yeah, I feel like I feel like every manufacturer and all the consumers need more room to play with this stuff. And I think
just the speed limit.
Yeah. Well, also, and then just have it blend into the motorcycle market nice and cleanly. So, like, it should just be, like, a spectrum where you don't know where the e-bikes end. You know, besides the pedals, like, you don't know where the e-bikes end and where the electric motorcycles start.
I would like that split to happen somewhere around 38 miles an hour.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who would be able to handle an e-bike doing that.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, for some reason 38, it's a couple more miles per hour than my scooter currently gets. And I could use a couple more miles per hour, but that's really it. And and that's it. Like, you know, and I think that what I do like about electric vehicles is what most people hate. Most people hate this idea that these vehicles are getting on the road and they're somehow like getting on the road lawlessly. And it's chaotic and it's creating unsafe situations and whatever. And I think people's thinking on that is completely fucking ass backwards. The road is not just for cars, right? The road is for livestock as well. It's for horses. It's for tractors, farming equipment, yeah, like tractors. It is for heavy construction equipment. It is for a lot of things. I remember a couple years ago when I rented a Genie lift to move that shed in my backyard and I just drove it across town.
Right.
It's completely legal.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it be?
Well, not only that,
you could drive a forklift on the fucking road if you need to, like for a legitimate work purpose. Now you gotta put flags and shit on it, but like the road is for a lot of things. It's not just for your fucking pickup truck.
Well, not only that, but, like, you know, when you're stuck in traffic and you just see that guy, like, you know, either go up the outside alongside the outside the fast lane or splitting traffic. Like, these are people who are now not another car in front of you. Like,
yeah,
this is saving you time. Well, it's like my position is I am fully on board with cyclists blowing stop signs. I think it's fantastic.
I do too.
Now you've got to accept all the liability for that, which yes, you know, you essentially do. But I would be against ever giving unless they actually didn't look and create an unsafe situation. But like by default, that being a ticketable offense, I'm against it. Bicyclists should absolutely be allowed to blow stop signs.
Now, if you T-bone a bicyclist and they blew the stop sign, I don't think you should be at fault.
I agree completely.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But
there's most a little people, good with bad there, but, you know,
most people,
they always have the option to stop.
But most people, you know, generally don't want to get T-boned, and they try and not do that. They try and not get hit. So, you know, yeah.
But my thing is, I hate
more organized chaos.
I've talked about this on the show before, but it bears repeating because I don't know anyone besides me that talks passionately about this. I fucking hate bicycle lanes. It's pointless and it's counterproductive. Every lane should be a bicycle lane. The lane is a bicycle. If there is no bicycle lane, how do people still ride on the roads? Because the best place to ride a bicycle, it turns out, is in the middle of the fucking road, right? In the middle of the lane where you've got the most visibility and you've got the most escape routes. That's it. Not off on the shoulder where cars are constantly fucking passing you and pushing you over and splashing you with water and doing all sorts of dangerous things. Fuck that. No. If you're somewhere where, like, the speed limit's under 40 and you're doing, like, 25 to 35 on your bicycle and, you know, you can do those speeds, just fucking do it and make people go around you and flip them the fuck off if they honk at you, because everyone could use a fucking reminder that the road isn't just for your fucking pickup truck. It's for a lot of things.
Yeah.
And a lot of car drivers could be reminded that they should look out for things like motorcycles and cyclists. I mean, another controversial opinion of mine is that I don't think cars present a statistically dangerous I don't think they have a statistically significant – they pose a statistically significant amount of danger for motorcyclists. I think they're way worse for cyclists than they are motorcyclists. It turns out if you're going to fucking die on a motorcycle, it was your own goddamn fault. The only thing that happens with any amount of regularity is a car turning left in front of you. But that's so much rarer than you think it is. The odds are like more than 90% that you're just going to ride too fast and not be able to make a turn. That's how you're going to crash your bike. That's how you're going to die on it. Riding over your personal limits is what's going to happen to you. Not get hit by a car. However, bicyclists get hit by cars all the fucking time. It's at much lower speeds. But, you know, getting hit at 20 miles an hour on foot or on a bicycle is a big fucking deal. You know, and often it's more. It's like 30 miles an hour you get hit. That's that, you know, cars could be reminded. And this is sort of the thing with the e-bikes as well. Like, hey, slow it the fuck down in town and realize that, you know, there's stop signs and shit. Whether you're doing 35 or 24, you're probably going to get across town with a difference of like 40 fucking seconds.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
So, I mean, to go back to what you said before, I wouldn't say I hate bicycle lanes, but bicycle lanes by themselves as like a stopgap solution to like separating traffic is a terrible idea. Like, I think the only place where it makes sense to have bicycle lanes is in places where like you've got to have only a two-lane road. And it's the only way to get traffic across, you know, two points. And it's too fast to have bicycles on there. And you're going to have, you know, people overtaking. But most of the time, if
it's a speed limit over 40 miles an hour, okay, put a bicycle lane on the side. Sure.
Yeah.
But
otherwise, I mean, what you really should have is you should have a better route for cyclists. And on that road, you have no bicycle lane. And all the cars just have to put up with how fast the bicycles are going. Like, yeah. You know, we've got a major road, West 10th, on here in Greeley, and that's four lanes, and you would never want to take your bike on there. But, you know, a few blocks over, there's other straight roads through that you absolutely would, you know.
Okay, I've got another secret question for you.
Okay.
That blends right into this. So on this idea of electric vehicles that are not a full-on electric car, they're not a bicycle, it's something in between. This also addresses a Patreon message we got. Have you seen the Moto Compacto?
I have. Now,
I'm not a huge fan. I'm not against it either. It's a little bit blah for me.
Let me put on my pretentious motorcycle journalist hat for a moment, and I'm going to say, okay, it's great that they're making it, and it's great, and it's nice that it's fun that it kind of mimics the style of the old Moto Compo, but it's basically just like a 400-watt e-bike.
Yeah.
That's all it is. I mean, and... You know what? There are actually...
Not even that.
Not like, only it that... It is
low.
Not only that, but there are other pre-existing folding e-bikes.
Oh, for half to three-quarters of the cost, yeah.
That are better than it already. The coolest thing about the Moto Compo was, you know, having the original idea to create that folding briefcase motorcycle, that scooter, and to fit a two-stroke motor in there to get all the controls working, to have it all fold up, and to have it as the accessory for the Honda City. That was really what the Moto Compo did. The Moto Compacto is really just an e-bike.
Well, yes and no. So the Moto Compact... So, okay. If you have your average American car, you're right. You can absolutely get a foldable e-bike of some description from Sam's Club, Walmart, Costco, Amazon, whatever, for $500 to $700, because the Moto Compacto is supposed to be $1,000 when they start selling it. And that's all well and good. And the idea is that you can drive 75% or 80% of your distance, you know, park somewhere that's not optimal, and then just spend your last few minutes scooting in to wherever you need to go, so you don't have to fight for parking and whatever. It's really like an anti-paying for parking device, right? The idea is you pay $700 to $1,000 or whatever for this scooter that fits in your trunk, so you can pay, you can be at either the cheap high-rise parking or free parking, you know, a mile from the city center, and just not have to deal with the fucking headache of meters and whatever. And
I don't know where
super expensive event parking.
The only place in America where I could see that making a lot of sense would either be, well, a big one would be university campuses. Not having to pay for, like, the on-site student parking.
Oh, yeah. Universities of all kinds are notorious for having some of the most asshole-ish parking police ever.
Yeah, there's
like
that.
Like, the Paul Blart factor is high on university campuses.
But the other would be, like, sporting events.
Right.
I could imagine. Concerts, yeah. I could imagine if you were a big baseball fan and you didn't want to, you know, three times a week pay more for parking than you did for your ticket, you could get one of these. And within a year, it would pay for
when
itself.
When Claire and I went to go see Taylor Swift, that's kind of what we had to do. We parked a bajillion miles away. Well, I was like 3 miles away or something for a reasonable cost. And we got bird scooters into the event. Now, this was only possible because this was such a huge event that, well, Lime was the company that did it, but they planted a bunch of extra scooters downtown and, you know, in all sorts of places where people would be to then scoot in. And then there were just like thousands of these things piled up outside the stadium. And then they kind of took them and they swapped out all the batteries and recharged and did all these things. So, and then moved even more of them to the thing. So when people exited, they could go again. So I'm sure they made like no money. They spent all these resources gathering up all these scooters and stuff for people so they could get into the event and out of the event. And it was all just advertising. Like, oh, maybe next time we'll use these Lime scooters. This was fun. This was whatever, you know, but you can't rely on that every time there's an event. You know, for Taylor Swift, sure, they're going to take notice and go, hey, people are going to be pissed that there's not going to be these scooters around. We're going to have to spend all fucking day moving these things around. They were driving around with these vans full of fucking batteries, just swapping them out like crazy. They couldn't do it fast enough, right? There's no way they made any money that day.
Yeah, and outside of a special event like that, like, I would never want to, like, daily rely on like a rentable scooter being available.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, like, who's monitoring the tire pressures and all of these things and, you know, and shit like that, right? So the idea to have your own is like, okay, so I said that, you know, if you have an American car, you can fit almost anything in the fucking trunk, right? But there is something to the form factor of the Moto Compacto, right? Because it's not very wide, right? The seat is like the, and the handlebars are the widest parts of it, but they fold down into nothing. The whole thing's something like, you know, like 7 inches across or something like that, because it goes, it folds into like something smaller than your average suitcase, right? And it can lay flat on your trunk. And, you know, this doesn't seem like a real big deal until you have a European size car, like a little two-door hatch or something, right? Now, all of a sudden, we're dealing with a whole different beast. You can't put, like, a stand-up Lime scooter in that. You know, or there's some foldable scooters that aren't going to work. Or if they do work, they're going to take up your whole trunk. Even though it doesn't take up all that volume, just the frame of the thing makes it impossible to put something else in there. So for some people, it might be worth the extra $200, $250 for the form factor that the Moto Compacto is in. So I get it. In the U.S., I don't think it makes a lot of sense, but in a place where people are using much smaller cars or potentially taking this thing with them, like on the train or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. If it rolls on wheels and you could take it into a train station and then, you know, you've got like a pretty far walk from your train to wherever you're going, it could make a lot of sense. It could. It's a few hundred bucks more, but that form factor plus the fact that it's Honda might be worth it. But this is something that's not good for the street. I think they said like the max speed was like 12 and a half miles an hour or something like that. This is for the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And so this isn't really even this isn't even really an e-bike.
It would be a class one. But yeah, it's not.
This would not be legal to ride on the road.
Yeah. I don't know.
Things that it's good for, but it's very limited in scope. It's basically something that if you determine like you spend like $800 a year on parking, then it's worth it for you to get this thing. And it's probably worth spending the extra $200 on the form factor of it as well.
Maybe you could sell it as a Goldwing accessory.
Perhaps. I mean, well, they're selling it as a car accessory.
Yeah.
It's not available through Honda Power Sports dealers. It's available through Honda car dealers because it sits in the trunk. And I think it's fantastic if it sits in the trunk and it can also charge when it's in the trunk. Because you buy it with like your Honda plug-in hybrid or whatever, and it sends extra power there or something like that. That makes a lot of fucking sense. But it's not really even an e-bike or a scooter or something like that. It's really the class of vehicle that like the ride on beer cooler is.
Right, yeah.
That's, if you owned a pickup truck and a ride on beer cooler, like you already have the convenience in your life of having a compact car with a Moto Compacto.
I mean, this sounds like it's going to be lower power than. I mean, it probably is significantly lower power than even like the Ego that runs off lawnmower batteries.
Right. Yeah. The Ego said it could do 28, and it's road legal. I don't think the Moto Compacto has a brake light or turn signals. Like, it really is the class, it really is the beer cooler class of vehicle.
I'm kind of wondering, at least in North America, like, state by state, there you might run into a lot of legal issues with that.
I mean, it's pretty hard to get pulled out. I don't know. I think you could, I think it's like riding a one wheel on the sidewalk. I don't think you're really going to have trouble with it. I mean, there's going to be those assholes that are like, this isn't a trail for motorized vehicles. What is up with those people, by the way? Can we take a minute to what is up with people that get upset? This isn't for motorized vehicles. And it's like, I'm doing 14 miles an hour. Chill the fuck out.
Yeah. It's sort of also like with all the people who are like closing motorcycle trails to like have more like walk like hiking paths and things. It's like, why is there a big influx of like people walking more? Last I checked, I don't think the national like the average BMI is going down right now.
In fact, people are spending more and more and more money to get their exercise without being outside. Have we ever, the Peloton, have we ever spent more money to pedal without going anywhere?
It's true.
Yeah. Right? Not since the Nordic track have people spent so much money.
Or the Bowflex.
The Bowflex. Well, yeah. Well, that wasn't pedal, but yeah. Yeah.
It was like a Rowan machine.
It was, but the Bowflex, it was like a bunch of like nylon, like rods that just took different amounts of force to like bend the on a pulley system.
I mean, it was essentially like this weird, like, upside down. Well, it was
the
gym
machine with the weights, except they were like, ooh, we can patent this with these weird, like, rods instead of weights.
That was an infomercial classic.
Oh, yeah. And the Nordic track, and it all fit in the corner of your home and slid under the bed. We had a Bowflex. Or I guess Dad had a Bowflex or whatever. I think it got about 18 months of use, and then it was just, yeah, it was, what a weird thing. Anyway.
I think we played on it more than he used it.
Yeah. There was always, like, some sort of idea of, like, okay, like, let's put it on the high, like, we were always trying to, like, fling, like, attach stuff to the flexi bits and see like what we could fling across the room with them. But there was that weird pulley system that always got in the way. The Nordic track to me was always a weird one because I was like, look, okay, so it mimics skiing, but it mimics cross country skiing, like the lamest kind of skiing. Right. If there was a machine that mimicked downhill skiing, I could have been way more on board. Right. If there was a machine where, like, you know, you leaned forward on it and you had to, like, you know, move the skis left and right like you were doing like moguls or something, that would have given you like a great like leg workout and been way more fun. You could have put like an old CRT TV in front of it and there could have been you could have pretended you were going around bumps or whatever. Or there could have been like a track with like bumps moving underneath you that you had to like, you know, clear left or right and it would give you a left or green light. There was a way to do it. But I was like, cross country skiing is lame already as it is. But why do we need to emulate cross country skiing? And then I thought, well, you know, also we could do this in real life too, right? Like rollerblades mimic ice skates. I was like, we could just have like really long rollerblades that, and you could just go like cross country skiing outside on the sidewalk and maybe get more out of it. I don't know why we need to have this inside. And then it's like, oh, well, what about if the weather's bad? Right? Well, it's skiing. If it's snowing outside, maybe you could cross country ski for fucking real. I don't know. I don't know why you need to do this in shelter, is my point. It's already a sport designed for inclement weather.
Yeah. Okay, so we're at an hour and a half now.
Yeah, I don't need to go on about the Nordic track anymore. But it's an insane idea, isn't it? That you need to recreate cross-country skiing inside. Okay. Yeah, I mean, unless you have, like, one more short secret question, I think we can end this.
I think we can end there.
All right, let's do like an intro and okay, so we're at the end of the episode. Swigs is with me, but possibly now you have heard an interview with the captain, unless he didn't make it up tomorrow, in which case this is just the natural end of the episode. So let's roll the outro, Swigs.
And I don't want to die, just want to ride on my motorcycle. Cold.